This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Elements of State Health Reform, a partnership with the National Governors Association. These interactive web shows look at the growing momentum for health reform in the states and probe the key issues policymakers face as they develop approaches to cover the uninsured and make healthcare more affordable. Today's the final show in our series, and we're looking at what is likely to be the biggest health issue Congress tackles this year, health coverage for kids. This year marks the 10th anniversary of SCHIP, a state-federal program designed to build on Medicaid to cover uninsured children. SCHIP now covers 6 million kids per year, on top of the 28 million covered by Medicaid. Since SCHIP began, the percentage of kids who are uninsured has fallen by more than a third, even in the face of declines in employer-sponsored insurance. Yet over 8 million children are still uninsured. SCHIP is now up for reauthorization in Congress, and there are a number of proposals for restructuring the program going forward. President Bush has called for SCHIP to be refocused, limiting coverage of children to families with incomes under twice the poverty level, and ending coverage for parents under the program. Bills in Congress would expand state options to cover additional kids and increase federal funding to keep up with the need. Though the future shape of SCHIP remains uncertain, states have not slowed their progress, and some have begun to put in place initiatives to move towards universal coverage for kids, building on a combination of Medicaid, SCHIP, and state-funded programs. We're joined today by officials from three of these states. Jason Helgerson is the Medicaid director for the state of Wisconsin. George Hoover is deputy commissioner for CHIP and adult basic programs in the Pennsylvania Insurance Department. And Jackie Ellinger is Deputy Administrator for Medical Programs in the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. You can ask questions of the panel at any time during the show by sending an email to ask@kaisernetwork.org. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Jackie, let's begin with you. Illinois was, I'd say, the first state out of the block in aiming towards universal coverage for kids. And give us a sense of what the impetus for that was. I mean, why the focus on kids?
Well, it was leadership from the governor, really, that started this. When Governor Blagojevich came into office in 2003, he pushed hard for us to raise the income levels of children in our SCHIP program at that time and to increase coverage for parents. And with his reelection to a second term, he has now launched universal coverage through, or is trying to launch universal coverage for all Illinoisans. In the last year of his first term, he launched coverage for all children. And so without regard to income level or whether the children are citizens or what status of immigrant or undocumented children, if they live in Illinois and they need health insurance, we can cover them. So really, it was the governor's leadership that launched it for us.
And what are the building blocks of the expansion for kids? I mean, how do you use Medicaid? How did you use SCHIP? What do parents have to pay for the coverage for their kids?
From the outset, when Illinois has expanded its coverage for children, and we really didn't expand coverage for children until SCHIP first became available. At that point, we were at the federal minimums under the Medicaid program. So all of our expansions for children until the governor launched all kids expansion in 2005, all of those expansions were financed with Medicaid, or all of the children were covered with Medicaid and then the SCHIP expansions. And we have always had a very highly integrated program so that families didn't have to decide where to go to apply. We had a single application, and we continue to have a single application, and we bear the burden of figuring out where we can get federal money for it and what income group the parents and children belong in. Our program has very modest, at the lower income levels, very modest premiums and co-payments.
That's to say under poverty, under 150% of poverty?
No, our premiums don't start until 150% of poverty. And at that level, one child can be insured for $15 a month for direct coverage under our program. And from there, it does grow with income, and at upper income levels, families are paying substantial premiums. But they are still, for those modest income families, very affordable.
And how about, I mean, nationally, three-quarters of the kids who remain uninsured are estimated to be eligible for public programs like SCHIP or Medicaid. What kind of steps have you taken to try and get those kids enrolled?
Well, we've certainly seen that to be true in Illinois. Since we started enrollment in all kids, the statewide expansion for all children was actually effective July 1, 2006. That's when coverage began. The program was announced and passed in the fall of 2005. So for that period of time, we had a huge outreach campaign. And since we've been enrolling over this last year, we've seen growth in children children enrolled at about 150,000. Of those, only 50,000 kids are eligible under the expansion. So we picked up 100,000 kids who were not otherwise eligible. And we think it's a combination of having a simple message, all kids means all kids, it's a single program statewide, multiple ways to apply, but a single application, and as much media exposure as the state can afford in the way of TV spots and radio. We really get a push that way. Because with the expansion to more children, the traditional methods of finding the poorest families through social service networks and healthcare providers doesn't work as well with higher income families. We need to find other avenues to reach them and get those kids enrolled.
In George Hoover, I mean, Pennsylvania's been covering kids through a state-only program for quite a while, even before SCHIP existed, right?
Right. We actually began to cover kids in 1993 in a state-only funded program, and then with the advent of Balanced Budget Act, it provided some federal dollars so that we could expand the program. It's grown from around 60,000 when we had a state-only program to about 161,000 kids right now. And again, our governor sent a clear message that health care was really important to him, Governor Rendell, when his first executive order that he signed upon becoming governor was the establishment of the Office of Health Care Reform. And that office has led efforts in the Commonwealth. We applied for a HRSA grant, used that HRSA grant to study the population. We also did a state-only survey to find out more about the uninsured, and as a result of that survey, we found out there was about 133,000 children that were uninsured. About 96% of the kids in Pennsylvania do have coverage, but with 133,000, that's 133,000 too many. So we set about trying to resolve that, and our expansion of health care coverage for kids was termed the Cover All Kids Initiative, but it was really an expansion to our successful CHIP program. We were not in it quite as early as Illinois was, but through state legislation and budgetary approval and then eventual federal approval of our state plan, we were able to begin to offer coverage to kids this March, and we're seeing a pretty good uptake already.
And how about, I mean, is your experience similar in that many of the kids you see coming in were already eligible for existing programs?
About half the kids that we've seen come in so far were eligible for existing programs. We've taken a look at what that data looks like. The majority of the kids who are uninsured in Pennsylvania are eligible or were eligible for the prior Medicaid and SCHIP program. Of those 133,000 kids, only about 25,000 were above the old populations. But we're seeing about half the kids that are coming in at this point in time appear to be kids that newly have the opportunity for coverage under our expanded CHIP program.
And what I mean, Jackie talked about some of the advantages of a universal program, being able to send a very clear message that all kids are covered or can be covered. Are there some challenges as well as you go up the income scale? I mean, to families that have more resources, that are more likely to have private insurance. I mean, what are some of the challenges in doing that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Those families probably have had private insurance somewhere in the past, and like other state programs, once families are above 200% of poverty, we do require a six-month period of no insurance or a six-month go-bear period. Also, higher-income families tend to believe that they're just between insurance programs. Maybe somebody had a job and had insurance, but they lost the job. They believe another job's right around the corner with insurance. But we're finding as employer-based insurance erodes, it doesn't necessarily mean that the next job will have insurance coverage with it.
And, you know, there's a lot of proposals out there now on the presidential campaign trail for universal coverage that involved an individual mandate. Massachusetts is poised to implement such a plan just a couple weeks that would require people to purchase insurance. Now, in a universal program for kids, do you think you can get to universal coverage of kids? I mean, truly covering all kids without that kind of mandate?
I think it becomes a little more difficult because even a lot of kids who receive Medicaid do go on and off the program with requirements such as annual renewals and so forth. There's a lot of reasons why families might drop off, or somebody may become employed in the family and they do get private insurance, but then once that employment's lost, there's again a gap. You know, one of the things that we are trying to do with our kids expansion is also to now look at covering all adults through our Cover All Pennsylvanians initiative, and we believe by broadly adding adults and kids into these programs, we're going to certainly decrease the number of uninsured people in Pennsylvania.
And Jason Tuggerson, let me bring you in. Wisconsin has been aiming at universal coverage for kids as well through Badger Care Plus. What's the status of that?
Right now, it's a budget proposal that the governor's made. It's actually made it through sort of halfway through the state budget process successfully. We're quite hopeful based on the reaction we've gotten actually from members of the legislature of both parties in terms of support of the idea that in a state like Wisconsin, which has really very, very low uninsured rates, particularly for kids, that we can make that final step forward and ensure that every child has access to affordable health insurance.
And federal approval is pending?
Federal approval is pending. We're actually in discussions right now. We're actually going to be one of those states that's going to try to use the Deficit Reduction Act, the flexibility that new legislation allows states. We're actually going to be requesting very little through actual 1115 waiver, much of what we're asking for. And actually, to be honest, what we're really asking for is flexibility to greatly streamline and simplify the program, which is a key part of what we think makes Badger Care Plus unique.
Give us some examples of how that streamlining would work.
Sure. Right now, there's roughly 20 doors one can go through to become eligible for one of three programs that exists in Wisconsin for low-income families. There's the AFDC-related Medicaid, which is very low-income individuals. There's what's called Healthy Start, which is another program that was an add-on to the basic Medicaid package a number of years back. And then there's what's called Badger Care, which is our version of an SCHIP program. And so each of these programs, and even within those programs, there's a whole bunch of different ways that income is tested, eligibility is determined, and that's a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of information that families need to provide. And families, although they may bounce from one program to another during a year, it has no effect on their health coverage. The health coverage is the same. And so what we're proposing to do is merge those three programs, significantly streamline them, go to one definition of income, not 20. And through that streamlining, we hope to actually get rid of a lot of the barriers that exist to low-income children getting access to health care.
Will that definition of income look most like one of the existing programs?
It's going to be a very close to gross income with a couple of minor adjustments. So basically what shows up on a person's check every week or every month will be basically what their income is. And so we think that by getting rid of all these adjustments that frankly have very little impact on someone's eligibility when we're talking about this subset of the population is really, we think, a major innovation that will help us get kids signed up for healthcare.
And part of this expansion has been aimed at bringing more parents into the program as well. I mean, George talked a little bit about covering whole families and the advantage that has. Is that something you found as well?
Absolutely. We're one of those states that our SCHIP actually covered adults, and we've made covering families a key part of our overall strategy for more than a decade. And I think what Badger Care Plus does and our experience with Badger Care and our other programs to date is that when you actually offer health insurance to the entire family, you actually are going to get a lot better uptake rates. Right now in Wisconsin, we estimate that roughly 50% of our uninsured kids appear to be eligible for our programs today, which is obviously less than the national average. So I think that our approach to date has really helped us in getting more kids signed up.
I'm going to move on to some of our email questions since we've gotten many. And the first concern is funding, which I'm sure is something you all think about quite a bit. And the question is about cigarette taxes as a way to fund children's health care, and this comes from Oregon. And let me start a little more broadly, Jackie, with you. There is state money in the expansions you undertook in Illinois. I mean, where did that come from? Was that just in the normal part of the budget process? Was there some earmarked funding?
For the most part, our match comes from state general revenue funds. And special taxes are cigarette taxes or other things are always an option. But at the end of the day, there are many demands at the state level, and it really depends on the political will to use what resources are available for coverage for children. When we started, when SCHIP was first launched in Illinois in 1998, when we launched our waiver, we did convince the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, HCFA, at that time, to allow us to match some state-only programs that brought us in some more federal money that we then turned around and used to cover more parents. They were pre-existing state programs, and they represent the adults who aren't parents who we cover in Illinois. It's only 1,500 people. It's not very many. In any event, but for them, you know, by far and away, this is state general revenue money for us.
And George, similar in Pennsylvania, is that?
We do use some cigarette tax money. It's basically general fund money and cigarette tax money. Those are the two primary sources.
And what were the politics of using the cigarette tax money? Was that?
Well, we actually got our state program started with cigarette tax money back in the early 1990s. And so once we had that in place, we've been able to add just a bit more to the cigarette tax and use additional general funds.
And how about issues of sustainability? I mean, have you been able to, is this a yearly struggle or do you feel that the funding is stable now, at least at the state level?
Yeah, I think it's been fairly stable. There was some interest when we went to the expansion recently about where the funding was going to come from. We, of course, are always required to do 5-year budget projections when we implement a new program so that we can be sure that we can sustain the program. And just based upon the fact that we've been good spenders of our dollars over time, we've actually had an excess of SCHIP dollars, so we do have some money in reserve. By having that money in reserve, we could see ourselves through that 5-year period without additional taxation.
And Jason, you talked about being in the middle of the budget process now. The governor's initiative was as a budget proposal. How are the funding discussions playing in that? Are they paramount? Are they part of the discussion?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing is that in terms of our expansion to cover more kids, since we are a state that covers the overwhelming majority of kids, over 96%, the cost implications of Badger Care Plus are not that significant. But in terms of the cigarette tax in particular, the governor has proposed a $1.25 increase in the cigarette tax, which we believe is the largest one-time increase in the cigarette tax any state's ever tried. But it's obviously we think the cigarette tax has twofold benefit. One, it actually is a revenue source that overwhelming majority of Wisconsin residents actually think in polls that they've done that suggest that that's something they think is appropriate. The governor's proposed to use that funding source to basically entirely for health care. And also it has the added benefit of reducing smoking, particularly youth smoking, which in Wisconsin is a problem. So we think that it's actually a very good policy choice.
And do you worry about people saying that if you're successful with a cigarette tax and reduce smoking, as you said, that you actually put yourself in a difficult position from a funding perspective?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the Medicaid budget in Wisconsin is about $5 billion. About $2 billion of that comes from general tax revenue. So actually, cigarette tax and the increase specifically, which is what's being earmarked, is actually a fairly small percentage of the total. But absolutely right. I mean, if we're successful and smoking decreases, it will certainly not be a growing revenue source, and potentially be a slightly declining revenue source, which we'll have to deal with. But I think in Wisconsin, healthcare has been a major priority. Despite some of the worst budgets in state history, we did not cut off a single individual from healthcare, which I think is a tribute to Governor Doyle's commitment to healthcare, particularly for kids.
And let me ask you, many states suffered budget problems in the last few years. Were there cutbacks in any of your states during that period? I mean, either moving backwards in terms of simplifying the process, doing outreach?
I can say for Illinois that we haven't had any cutbacks in eligibility or the scope of benefits covered, but we've done a lot to reduce our spending in the area of drug prices, and particularly, and also we are now launching a new primary care case management system, which some people may be well aware of. We have not been a heavily managed care state in Illinois, but our all kids expansion was, you asked me about taxes for financing it, but it was financed by finding the money within the existing budget through both primary care case management and a new disease management initiative. So to improve service delivery and at the same time utilization of services and reducing the cost. So that's the way we've been able to hold the line there.
Well, and let me follow up. We had another question from your home state of Illinois. How much of what is spent for SCHIP goes to the insurance industry and how much to care providers? And you talked about not being a heavily managed care state. I mean, is that has that been controversial, moving to a primary care case management?
Actually, I don't think it has. And primary care case management actually doesn't involve insurance companies much. We have some managed care in Illinois. It's been voluntary under the Medicaid program. We don't require people. We haven't required people to use HMOs, but they've had that choice in about 6 of our counties where HMOs operate. primary care case management is a system where individuals who participate have to enroll with a primary care provider who then controls their care and refers them for other
care. And that's through the traditional program, not necessarily.
And that's through the traditional program. And we're still paying those doctors directly or the clinics who participate directly. And they don't take on any risk for services. So the state is still bearing the risk for the services that are provided. It's actually so far going pretty well. We're implementing slowly in stages and carefully, but we think it's going to work well.
How about Pennsylvania's Wisconsin? I mean, are your programs run heavily managed care?
Pennsylvania's programs are heavily managed care. In the Medicaid program, about two-thirds of the eligibles are enrolled in managed care. And in the ESCHA program, everyone receives their services through a managed care program. So we're pretty saturated with managed care in Pennsylvania.
Right. Of the Badger Care Plus population, over 70% is in managed care, and our goal within the next couple of years is to get to basically almost close to, as close as you can get at 100%, with obviously allowing some people with complex conditions to opt out. But it's a big part of our initiative.
And have you used, for the sake of a better term, mainstream insurance plans, I mean plans that are generally available to the commercial population, or more targeted Medicaid-only or ESCHIP-only?
We actually have a good mix, and it's interesting because we're moving into pay-for-performance within managed care, which is going to be interesting to see as we actually put portions of the capitated rate at risk based on their actual ability to achieve specific performance measures, how the various plans compete and do. But, yeah, we have commercial plans as well as Medicaid-only.
And in Pennsylvania, we have the same, too. We have a combination, especially in the ESCHIP program, we have 8 contractors that serve individuals in the state, and about 5 of those are just commercial plans. 3 are also Medicaid plans.
I also had a question from North Carolina about the relative merits of enrolling children in Medicaid or ESCHIP versus providing premium assistance to get them enrolled in private insurance. And we talked earlier about some of the challenges as you move up the income scale in terms of families having more resources, being more likely to have private insurance. Have any of you built in any premium assistance for private insurance into your plans?
Illinois has. It's because of the artifact of the way the federal law is structured, we do it in a curious way. It's only available, I think it's curious, to families between 134% and 200% of poverty, because to offer it to families at the Medicaid level, the federal requirements, Jason talked about trying to get away from some of the incredible requirements embedded in Medicaid law, are just too difficult administratively to do it at that level. But we've handled that by letting families choose what they want to do. Under our ESCHIP program and with our ESCHIP waiver, families can move in and out of direct coverage. They can keep their private insurance and take direct coverage. They can not take direct coverage but choose our premium assistance instead. We call it All Kids Rebate. And we found that has been very effective for families to choose what works best for them.
Premium, what percentage of kids end up being covered under the premium assistance?
I don't know that number off the top of my head, but it's relatively small. It is really, it's not a whole lot, but it does allow families to take advantage of that employer-sponsored plan.
Yeah, and along those lines, I think that we are actually proposing some significant changes to basically allow us to do it. Right now, we have a program that's fairly small, but we actually think that through some administrative changes, we can open it up to a whole new set of people. One example is right now, we have to basically be able to buy people into family coverage, which tends to have a much more, it's lower employer subsidy to those types of plans. But we think that if offering an opportunity where we might just buy an adult in, the parent, into the insurance through the employer and then cover the kids through the regular plan might be a way to get more adults into private insurance.
So you would just sort of take that mixed approach, that you would actually do the premium assistance for the parent but keep the kids in the
school. Absolutely. And we think that change in and of itself will help us significantly increase the number of people, because we definitely want to keep the employer-sponsored insurance system up and running. And I think whenever you expand to higher incomes, that's one concern you always have to take into account.
And is there, I mean, when ESCHIP was first passed, now 10 years ago, there was a lot of concern about crowd out, about the expansion in public coverage crowding out private insurance. What's the experience been? I mean, is that something you've actually noticed happening a lot in your states?
We've measured crowd out, tried to measure crowd out effectively each year since our program's been in place, and we've really never seen any evidence of real crowd out. But there was a real concern about that when we did our expansion program, because now we were going to cover children in higher income levels. So two of the parameters that we've worked with in Pennsylvania to try and minimize crowd out is one, to have for individuals above, children and families with incomes above 200% of poverty, there is a six-month go-bare period, except for kids under the age of two. There is no go-bare period regardless of what income is. But we also do a match prior to authorizing anyone above 200% of poverty. We do a match with a third-party source that can tell us whether or not any of those children have had insurance anytime within the last 6 months. It's working out quite well. There was a concern that maybe families would come to us and not have met that go-bare period. So we instituted a match, and it's working out quite well.
We got another email question about undocumented immigrants, and this came up a little earlier as well. And Jackie, you said Illinois does cover undocumented immigrants. Now, you can't use federal money for
that's
that, right?
We can't unless it's an unborn child, a pregnant woman. We are using federal money to buy prenatal care services for undocumented pregnant women.
And are these kids in or women in the same program as everyone else? It's
yes.
Just you're segregating
yes.
the financing, not
yes.
not the coverage.
Yes, that's right. But we also cover children who are undocumented if they are residents of Illinois. We've dropped the requirement that they show us that they have either a citizenship or alien registration status here.
And has it been an issue in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania?
We are not proposing under Medicare Plus to cover undocumented population because it is a Medicaid expansion. But we are, and actually we're doing it through SCHIP, is the coverage of the undocumented pregnant women. And it's been a highly successful program because it's good that the federal government at least recognizes that when that child is born and we are then therefore bearing the financial cost of that, that it makes sense to make sure that the parent, the mother, gets prenatal care because it's so essential. But that part has been a successful program already.
I want to come back to this idea of enrollment outreach and simplification. And Jackie talked about some of the steps they took in Illinois. And we had a question about enrollment to reach the lowest income of the group, people under poverty. And George, talk a little bit about what you've done in Pennsylvania to bring kids in,
well,
particularly the lowest income kids.
We believe the cover all kids message is certainly going to resonate. One of the things we had done is through the Gallup survey group, we had tried to study to see whether or not people were well aware of the CHIP program and what their impression was. And we found out that, yes, 90% of people are aware of CHIP, and most of those folks have a favorable impression. But also we found out that families thought, even some of the lower-income families, that we considered them not me's. They thought because somebody was working in the family that they probably weren't eligible. And we believe the all-kids message, cover-all-kids message, now makes families realize that while they will be eligible, despite the fact that there is income, it would just mean a difference in terms of the premium that they would pay.
And this is in some sense, I mean, because the truth is not all kids are eligible for a subsidy in Pennsylvania. I mean, the highest income kids, families have to pay can buy into the program, but pay full cost. But just the mere fact of this universal or all kids message, you're finding is able to.
Right, it provides an opportunity. And as you said, you're correct. Below 200% of poverty, there are no premiums. Between 200% and 300% of poverty, the premiums range from about $38 a month to about $60 a month per child. And then above 300% of poverty, as long as insurance is either inaccessible or unavailable to the child, the family can buy coverage. And that averages about $150 per month per child. But there's no federal or state subsidization involved with that.
One other thing I think that at least we're trying in Wisconsin, which we hope will actually help us get some of those really low-income kids, is presumptive eligibility, which is really a way to open the door to a whole new range of options for getting kids signed up. Presumptive eligibility basically allows you to go through a much more streamlined process for signing a child up and basically allows paperwork, things like identity, citizenship requirements, to basically catch up and get a child access to care that might have otherwise taken a month or so to get access, might have been the initial thing that stopped that parent from thinking, oh boy, this is just something I'm not going to be able to deal with or be able to access. And so we think through that we'll be able to have community centers, YMCAs, WIC clinics, public health departments, a whole wide range of actors now become part of the process of getting kids signed up for healthcare, which we think would be a very powerful force. So you don't have to go down to the county welfare office to get access to healthcare. You can go to your school on the first day of school, and by having somebody with limited training with access to the internet, we think will be a major improvement in access to healthcare for kids.
And you mentioned the documentation requirements that were put in place recently in Medicaid. What's been your experience with those?
Yes, I think we have or at least we've been told we have the best statistics on this, and we have seen a significant negative effect. Over 10,000 individuals losing access to the programs because of the new requirements. The overwhelming bulk of those individuals lost it because of the identity requirement, the actual having a picture ID. Interestingly enough, we were able through data matching to ensure that to determine that basically 90% of our current program participants actually are citizens, which actually shouldn't be any surprise to anybody who's actually looked at this issue seriously. But yet we still have this ID requirement, which is really problematic. And so what we hope to do is that what presumptive eligibility does is it allows some of these things to catch up. It doesn't mean that if you show up on day one, you'll get automatically rejected, told to go home, find, a picture ID for your 12-year-old child or get one made. This way, at least you can get determined eligible and then therefore, find the ID and gives you a number of weeks to get that accomplished.
And so even the families that were lost in the shuffle through the identity requirement, not all of them were actually ineligible. It was simply the requirement itself.
Well, yeah, and that's what we strongly suspect. Considering we were able to prove their citizenship, chances are, it's just a question of making sure they have the picture ID. I mean, we think that over time, as people have adjusted the procedures, we've caught a lot of those people back, and it's kind of hard to determine exactly who we haven't gotten back. It was a major problem when it was first implemented, and it just was one of those things. It was not a well-thought-out policy at the federal level that caused a lot of angst and a lot of cost at the state level in terms of trying to deal with it.
And Jackie, Illinois has been doing the outreach efforts for quite a while now. Is this a one-time thing, or is it something that has to be sustained?
The outreach? Outreach is something that I think has to, because there are new children all the time and their families coming and going, and because employment status changes, I do think it does need to keep going, although having an all-kids program, all-kids is still relatively new to us. That branding is relatively new. I think it will, the longer we stick with that name, the more it will become routine, but We do see every time we have a media push, we do see a bump in applications, and we do see a bump in enrollment that tends to flow out of that. So I think it's part and parcel of an overall, of every strategy you can use. Jason mentioned presumptive eligibility, which we've been doing for a long time. About 2 years ago, we eased it up on the redetermination process in Illinois to make it easier if families don't have changes. We just allow the children to continue enrolled. We have 12 months of eligibility. That whole array of things that takes families who really have very little means, at the lowest levels, very, very little income, no discretionary income, and probably very little energy to deal with things they don't have to deal with. And so if your child isn't sick, getting that message across that it's important to have preventive health care and preventive dental care is really tough. So I think that to the extent that you can maintain a general presence with the general media so that everybody knows this is available. Children should get health care. We're trying to make it a right. We've made it available. Come take use of it now. Make use of it now.
George also talked about some of these families being between jobs and coverage, or at least believing they're between coverage. The kind of steps you're talking about, say 12 months guaranteed mm-hmm. coverage, raising income eligibility levels, presumably stabilizes the program to some extent as well. I mean, minimizes the turnover.
That's one thing we certainly hope. It does. We still, though, demand premium payments, and even at those levels, it's sometimes tough for parents to keep up the premiums. And so that would be the one thing I think that most frequently disrupts coverage is that they stop paying their premium, and then we do have some barriers in place for getting back in. Because when we established our program, there was a goal to make it look like private insurance or employer-based insurance, and to get that insurance, you have to pay for it whether you use it or not. And that's a message that we are still is a philosophy that underpins the program, but it does cause some disruptions.
And George, you talked about putting in place premiums for the let's say higher lower income families, and then asking families above three times poverty to pay mm-hmm. to pay the full cost. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience with that as a deterrent to enrollment?
I mean, again, early on, well, I can speak to this. Prior to our expansion, we did have a component of our program that went from 200% of poverty to 235% of poverty, where a family paid half the premium. That averaged about $65, $67 a month. And families told us at that income level that was a tough premium to sustain. So that when we developed the premiums for cover all kids, actually that same group that had to pay $67 or $65 a month now only has to pay about $38. We were sensitive to the ability for families to pay, and we tried to develop our premiums with that in mind while still having an upper level cap of above 300% of poverty paying the full cost. I did want to add one other point too that I think is really important to understand about keeping families connected. And that's the importance of community partners and community agencies. An awful lot of folks may or may not respond to a TV ad that we do or a piece of literature that they find. But if they have someone that they trust in the community that's willing to explain the program to them or maybe can even lead them to the program, that can be quite helpful. I also think there's folks that no matter how hard, and probably the collective three of us have spent many, many years trying to make forms simple, and at the end of the day, you know, you just got to ask for a lot of information, and some forms can never be totally simple. So we have over-the-phone enrollment. We've added over-the-phone enrollment where folks can call a 1-800 number, and the enrollment can take place over the phone. An application can be submitted for them, as well as a reapplication, because I think some folks are just always going to struggle, whether it's a literacy level or whether it's the terminology that we maintain's got to be simple but just quite isn't simple. I think that presents a struggle. So I think by having our arms out to the community and having the community help us enroll as well as re-enroll children, we'll be more successful.
And working through community partners, does state provide funding to these organizations to help out with this?
Well, we really don't. We had at one point in time funded 20 mini grants, and those were small grants that ginned up a lot of activity. And I do have to tell you that when we started that, we weren't sure how many organizations would be interested. We got about 180 applications from organizations around the state. And what we found is not only we funded those 20, but many of the others that we had to deny, it actually generated some interest and built up some momentum that they went out and found funding through other sources. And some of that funding still continues today. So there's an awful lot of folks that when you plant the idea really want to do a good job to try and help you enroll kids.
I'd like to talk about what Illinois does in the way of community partners, because it's really a really important part of our plan. And we do pay, but we pay for a particular kind of performance. So we have established all case application agents. They sign a little agreement with us, and we train them. Their job is to take applications, assist families in completing applications. They only get paid if the application they send us is for a family that has not already been enrolled. So they have to check so we don't get duplicate applications. And it has to be a new enrollment, not just adding a child to a case. And the application has to be complete. I think George made a great point about we really do struggle to make these simple, but the laws just aren't simple. And the information we need to decide how to pay a medical bill, that isn't simple either. So these application agents have been very productive for us. The applications that we get from these folks who we pay usually result in, over time, they've resulted into 80 to 90% payment, which means 80 to 90% of the time they're finding families who are not already attached to us and whose children, who give us complete information to make that decision. So that's been very productive. It was a little tough to get off the ground and to put the payment system in place, but in the long run it has been very productive and they've been great partners.
And how about collecting premiums? I mean, it's actually not a common function for a Medicaid agency or a public welfare department. I mean, there have been logistical administrative challenges in making that work?
So far, it's working well for us. All of the premiums are collected by our contractors. and those are contractors that are used to having premium systems for their private insurance. So we put the responsibility on the contractors. That's who the premiums are paid through. And I think that's one of the reasons why our program works so well. In the CHIP world, families identify with their healthcare contractor. They never really have to work with the insurance department, since their relationship, both for application, for renewal, and premium payment, is always through their healthcare contractor.
And you, I mean, you're in the insurance department.
Yes.
Is that historically how this program has been run out of the insurance department?
Absolutely. Yeah. When the program first started with one person back in 1993, that it was decided that it would be started in the insurance department. And I think that does help families decide that what they're applying for is insurance. But it's remained in the insurance department. We actually think that that helps make our program successful. As people, because the CHIP program is a form of health insurance, and it certainly resonates with families in terms of they respond. When we do advertisements, quite often about 40% of the applications that we receive, we actually send over to the Medicaid agency, because people respond to ads about insurance, about health care, and I think we probably are the best outreach effort for the Department of Public Welfare, who manages the Medicaid program in Pennsylvania.
And Jason talked about the idea of streamlining. Have you all thought about this?
We're actually in the process of doing is actually turning into a one-page application form. I mean, that's literally what we're seeking to do in the Deficit Reduction Act, is to get enough
front
flexibility.
Front back.
Small print.
Application. But we actually in Wisconsin run a program called Senior Care, which is the last Pharmacy Plus waiver program that exists in the country. And what our experience with that was seniors sign up for this program all across the state, love it, would stand up and cheer and say, I'm part of this program. And most of those seniors have no idea they're on Medicaid. And what we're trying to do with our low-income family population through Badger Care Plus is go to a program that and try to the greatest degree possible eliminate the stigma associated with signing up for a quote public welfare program. We want to do many more applications via the internet, which we have a very good tool that we can already utilize, plus over the phone, which we've been doing for years. And so through this mechanism, we hope to make it so that people will not even, they get their little card, says, you know, Badger Care Plus on it. And like the senior care population today, it serves over 100,000 people, to have them not even think about the fact that they're on Medicaid. And that's going to be a time, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I think in order to really get people, particularly those folks who are a little hesitant to sign up because they think, well, if I have a job, well, I'm not on, you know, public assistance, therefore I'm not eligible. We need to get those people to start thinking about how healthcare is an essential thing. And it's a right that everybody has, and in our state they have access to it. And so I think that's going to be a major initiative that's really going to take years to really try to hone if we're going to be successful.
And this idea of using the internet for application, is that, I mean, are you finding that may be an effective strategy for families directly or for application assistants?
It's both. I mean, we couldn't believe when we actually put it up, and we've been expanding its use ever since for the existing population. I can't even remember the number of hits we got in the first month that we had it up and running, but it was incredible, over 10,000 or something like that hits. And so we think that it's actually a growing tool that, yeah, individual families can access, or that individuals who, organizations, churches. I mean, I think that's one of the other organizations we're particularly excited to work with, and part of our plan are mini grants to try to give out to individuals, because in a lot of times the best messenger is not somebody who works for the state or works for a county welfare office. It's somebody at a church or in the community who understands that person, knows that person, and convince them this is a good program for them. Because it's not just about getting access to services that day. It's about buying an insurance policy or getting in a program that gets you that preventative care. And that's a lot more one-on-one communication that's necessary to really convince people why that's important.
I want to come back to some of our email questions. We've got a number of questions about the benefits in these programs, the actual covered services, whether it's substance abuse services, EPSDT under Medicaid, prevention services, which you mentioned. And Jason, you've talked about simplifying these multiple programs, multiple routes in. Does that also involve simplifying the coverage? I mean, and making uniform coverage across
the state? Under Badger Care Plus, basically for the existing population who are currently eligible for our programs, they'll continue to have the same rich Medicaid benefit they have today. For the higher income individuals, we designed a benchmark plan consistent with what the Deficit Reduction Act calls for, which is gives states flexibilities in benefit design. It's much more closely rooted to, in fact, it's based on the most subscribed to HMO plan in the state of Wisconsin. And so our idea is we'll offer these two different benchmark or two different benefit packages. And the idea there is to help minimize crowd out at the higher ends, but trying to, at the same time, keep it pretty simple so people understand what it is that they're eligible for.
And George, what was your experience when you created the originally estate-only program and the S-CHIP program? Was this a program that had different benefits from Medicaid?
Yes, it actually had lighter benefits than Medicaid. We have added some benefits since that point in time, but it doesn't have like the early screening kind of coverage that you receive under Medicaid. But we come up with a plan that, not unlike what Jason talked about, the Medicaid program provides the extensive coverage with wraparound services. But our CHIP benefit is more like the private commercial HMO type coverage. Standard program, good program, pharmacy, mental health services, maybe not as extensive as under Medicaid, but still families are really tell us that they're pleased with the benefits they receive under the CHIP program.
In fact, you talked about not primarily making use of private managed care, but how about the benefits? Are there still different benefits between Medicaid and...
There are very minor differences. They are very minor. We have a very broad coverage, and I think we want to keep it that way. We deal with the upper-income families by having much more aggressive copayments and much higher premiums for them. But, in reality, those children who need higher, more expensive services can bankrupt a family, a middle-class family, faster than anything else. One of the hottest issues in our state is children with autism. Many of those families are, at least they look like they're well off, but the cost of services are overwhelming. So we've dealt with it by asking those higher-income families to contribute more on the front end, but not curtail the benefit package.
I want to. We're approaching the end of the hour, and I want to talk a little bit about the S-CHIP reauthorization process, which I'm sure is front and center for all of you in running these programs. Jackie, I mean, there are a number of issues in this reauthorization process. There's the overall funding level and the allocations to states. There's some proposals, as I mentioned earlier, by the president to refocus the program, to limit enrollment to kids under 200% of poverty, to limit coverage of parents. Going into this process, what are your biggest worries or your biggest hopes?
We rely very heavily on S-CHIP funding to finance our parent coverage. And there aren't a lot of states that have done that. It's been a controversial issue, but it's really important to us. We started, when Governor Blagojevich came into office, we covered parents at 50% of poverty. That's as far as we had gone.
Give us a sense of what the income level is.
It would
be under $10,000.
Yeah, that's for about a family of four. Yeah, it would be very low. I don't even like to think about it. So going back to that, it's inconceivable in some respects, but I think that it will have a really detrimental effect on enrollment of children. Because as we have looked at enrollment, our enrollment of children, our threshold of eligibility for children last changed in the year 2003. Parent income eligibility continued to rise after that time in Illinois. So even though the children's income threshold didn't change, as the parents' threshold changed, so did the enrollment of children. So they track really closely. So it looks like, on paper at least, it surely looks like treating a family as a family is a powerful effect in getting everybody covered and getting kids covered. Because often it'll be the parent who needs the health care, and the whole family comes along and the children get covered at the same time. So that parent coverage is very important. The overall funding amount is key. We've, across the states, in various ways, made tremendous progress here, and it would be a terrible thing to cut that back in the name of some sort of equalization to keep everybody, at the lowest common denominator? I mean, that hardly seems like a productive way to use the money. And then I think state flexibility. If the state has the money within its allocation to raise the income threshold to 300% of poverty, why not? Why not cover more families? I mean, these are still working families without a lot of discretionary income, and their children definitely need that health care. So there are many other things. Not imposing that citizenship documentation requirement under S-CHIP would be a key. Basing the funding allocation formula on what states actually spend rather than trying to base it on the uninsured child population in the state, because I think one thing we've proven is we don't have good measures of that. Illinois one time paid for study. We spent $500,000 to do our own study of how many uninsured children we have in the state. What we've mostly seen is the current population survey just doesn't do a very good job on a state-by-state basis, year-by-year basis. It's just not a good enough tool. It's a very crude measure, and it doesn't
work very well.
Where has
Illinois been with its allocation? I mean, have you used
with
the full allocation?
With the full, we've used more than our allocation. Early on, we failed to use all of our allocation and recommitted ourselves to make certain that we didn't. And so if you look at redistributed funds that other states have not used, you'll see in recent years that Illinois got a very substantial portion of those. So we've been very aggressive at using SCHIP money.
And, George, you talked about not using the full allocation in Pennsylvania, right?
Right, and that really helped us quite a bit, Larry, when we went to CMS, who was very helpful to us in the process, when we went to them and said, right about the same point in time that the president was saying he wanted to focus at 200% of poverty is when our state plan was in front of CMS, and there we were wanting 300% of poverty. But because we had money in reserve, and at the beginning of the year we had about $165 million in reserve, that was not a big issue. CMS told us that we were wise spenders in the past, so they didn't have that concern. The biggest discussion with CMS, with the state plan in Pennsylvania, was to have the no-go bear period for kids under the age of two. And that actually was not part of the original discussions, but we had the Pennsylvania Academy of Pediatrics, who worked very closely with us, as well as a number of organizations around the state, that convinced us that, including our Secretary of Health, that convinced us that we didn't want to have any child under the age of two miss any of those very important immunization visits and well baby visits. Actually, when we had our state plan discussions with CMS, there was much more of a discussion on how are we going to measure crowd out for that population under the age of two, and we've agreed to help them study that issue by looking at individuals between the ages of birth and two, and comparing that with any kind of crowd out numbers that we could find for individuals in the 2 to 5 year age group. But Jackie did a great job covering the issues that relate to SCHIP. Flexibility, I think, is extremely important. States really have just been able to grow their programs to what they think works best for them, and the population may not be the same in every state. I think as long as a state can live within its allocation, they should be permitted to be able to have the flexibility to have that work best in the state.
And are you looking for additional flexibility or just avoiding less flexibility?
I would say avoiding any strings that are attached. We're hoping to... We think we've got good flexibility at this point. We would, of course, I think, like other states, like the opportunity to be able to have children of government employees. You know, that's those folks can be enrolled. Those kids can be enrolled in Medicaid, but they can't be enrolled in an SCHIP program. So that's a disparity. We would like a little more flexibility in that area.
And you have government employees in Pennsylvania who would qualify.
Yes, unfortunately, we do. Yeah, we have some folks that would fall within the income levels. And now, especially since we've expanded the program, folks could buy in almost at any level. So, again, we'd like that flexibility. I think what I've also seen in the SCHIP legislation, or at least in the Snow-Rockefeller bill, was the possible even repeal of the citizenship identity requirements for Medicaid, at least making it a state option. I think a lot of states would like to have that option to be able to make that decision themselves. So, again, probably more flexibility in just those couple areas.
And Jason, I'm gonna give you the last word here. I mean, you're in the middle of this process of developing a program going forward. I mean, first talk about what is it in SCHIP that allows you to do this. I mean, what are the pieces of SCHIP that you're using?
Right. Basically, SCHIP right now for us, and it will be under the new program, is just a funding source. It's not a separate. We don't run it as a separate program. Our goal is to have basically one program that serves all the low income family and kids in the state. And so really for us, what we want to make sure of is that SCHIP actually is a funding source we can access, because like Illinois, we cover adults. And frankly, we were a state that had coverage pretty high up into the income levels under Medicaid before SCHIP even existed. And so what we're concerned about is we could get in a situation where we're basically ensuring that every child has access to health insurance, covering, 96, 97, 98% of all kids, that we're going to be potentially leaving $20, $30, $40 million on the table at the federal level in unused SCHIP money. I mean, that's kind of what we're looking at, and it's sort of hard to explain that to the legislators, to reporters, to advocates who say, how is it that you can't do this? Well, it's somewhat of an accident in history. We were more aggressive in the past. We sort of were covering kids before covering kids was cool, and SCHIP was created 10 years ago. So I think those are the things that we're very hopeful is that we'll be able to continue to be able to see SCHIP as a valuable revenue source to help us with our goal of ensuring that every kid in Wisconsin has access to health care.
Could you do it without reauthorization at the kind of levels that are being talked
about?
Well,
as long as we can cover adults under Medicaid, which is somewhat of an issue that we're hearing lately, we may be able to do that, which would be devastating, not just for Wisconsin, for lots of states. Mm-hmm. But it basically becomes a differential between the two rates.
The two matching rates.
Exactly. And so, obviously it'll make it more difficult, but we don't see it as sort of catastrophic. But, I think what's more disconcerting is we're in an environment where people want to cover more people and they want to allocate more federal dollars to do it. And the thought of leaving $30 to $40 million on the table just seems very disconcerting to us.
And talk about it. I want to end talking about where you go from kids. I'm sure you don't feel like you've succeeded quite yet, but at least all three of your states are on the way to at least universal access and possibly close to universal coverage of kids. Is this a platform to build on for covering everyone? Certainly your governors have talked about that. You're on its way. I mean, is that the next step?
Well, we're trying to do it in Illinois. Our governor has proposed Illinois Covered, which is universal access to health care for all Illinoisans. And it's a much more blended kind of model than what we've had with children, but it definitely builds on what we've done with kids. That's right now in the middle of a legislative fight over doing it and financing it. I think financing it has been the bigger issue. There is tremendous support in states, at least in our state, for making healthcare available to people. I mean, there is just this expectation now that we should be able to make this happen. So I think this is the first year of my governor's second term. He has so far never flagged his interest in healthcare expansion. Has never flagged. I think we'll continue moving in that direction and building on the successes that we've had so far.
And George, I mean, you talked earlier about Pennsylvania actually expanding coverage to kids before SCHIP, and it seems like you might be in a similar position for adults as well.
Right, the Governor Rendell's proposal for Cover All Pennsylvanians, that's really just a piece of the overall prescription for Pennsylvania. I mean, we believe coverage for adults is important, but we also believe if we only go to coverage for adults and costs continue to increase, it's going to continue to be unaffordable. So really, the Cover All Pennsylvanians component of the prescription for Pennsylvania is just one piece. We're trying to reduce hospital-acquired infections, deal with chronic care better. We think that if we can somehow decrease the cost of care as well as or at least minimize any kind of additional growth in the cost of care, that means covering adults will be more sustainable for us in the long term. So it's really just part of a much larger picture to try and turn around the delivery of health care in an effective and efficient manner in Pennsylvania.
As wise spending Pennsylvanians, right?
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us. And I want to thank all of you for joining us for Elements of State Health Reform. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org.